This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. And did you know, that Bloomberg Government is the only information service provider in Washington that focuses on the business impact of government actions? That's key. Business impact of government actions. Day in and day out, that's exactly what you'll find on www.bgov.com. That's BGOV.com. Partnered now with Federal News Radio, our buds at 1500 AM, bringing that concept right here to the airwaves every Thursday at 11 AM, along with Fridays at 2:30. You want to find out more? It's real simple. www.bgov.com. It's all out there for you. Today on Capital Impact, we're bringing the world of finance into focus. And to do so, well, we'd be remiss if we didn't turn our focus towards the world of J.P. Morgan. At this point, I'm guessing just about everybody knows the name Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan. You know, the company basically lost a $2 billion bet. If you aren't aware of this, well, you might want to pay attention because people like the U.S. Justice Department and the FBI of New York have now begun a criminal investigation into this, asking tons of questions. In fact, they're actually asking more questions than the shareholders did at their big meeting in Tampa on the 15th. Found that kind of interesting. Talk about that a little bit more a little bit later on. But big questions like, why did it happen? You know, where are the rules that would prevent this from happening? And what happened to good old-fashioned risk management? Big question mark there. I'm joined by a couple of people who are intimately aware of the problems in the finance industry and know a lot about this J.P. Morgan story. Both senior economic analysts with Bloomberg Government. Please welcome Neela Richardson and Christopher Payne to the program. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you for having us here.
By the way, they both are PhDs, so why they're hanging out with me, I don't know. But that aside, we're going to pick their brains for a little while. Both of you got together and worked on an insight for Bloomberg Government. It's called J.P. Morgan Losses Prove Need for Basel, Not Volcker. Interesting. Neela, before we get into the analysis contained therein, why don't you get us up to speed on exactly what happened with J.P. Morgan.
Sure, I'd love to, Alan. You know, I spend most of my days at Bloomberg Government looking at the business impact of government action, but the real story behind the situation at J.P. Morgan is how their actions are going to affect government decision-making going forward on how to regulate risk management. So to review and to answer some of the questions that you posed in setting this up, The whole idea, the whole question that the government regulators from the OCC, the SEC, CFTC, and now the Justice Department is going to have to grapple with is this a mountain or is this the molehill,
right,
this loss? And I have to say it's both. In terms of losses, it's a molehill for J.P. Morgan.
I was about to say, I mean, $2 billion, that's walking around money for them.
That was 1 month of earnings last year. This company made $25 billion right, pre-tax last year. That is just 1 month. They are well capitalized. They have almost $190 billion in shareholder equity. Mm-hmm. And so they are well capitalized to absorb this kind of loss. However, reputationally, it is a mountain for J.P. Morgan.
Right.
J.P. Dimon was thought to be the smartest banker on Wall Street, and he has been put forth as basically the king of the hill, the king of the street, to tell you what's wrong and what's right about Dodd-Frank. And he received a lot of legitimacy and credibility on Capitol Hill and at the regulatory agencies. That reputation has been damaged by this loss, a loss that in actuality was based on a hedge meant to protect the company for risks on the asset side.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can talk more about this hedge later, but the whole idea that this loss is somehow endemic of Wall Street is actually, in my view, misappropriated. The real story here is how the messaging behind this loss will be used on Capitol Hill.
Good point. Good point. Chris, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, the problem here, really, is essentially that you know, people don't understand that hedging, and that's really what was going on here, an attempt to hedge, as Neela says, some of their exposures to corporate loans and the corporate bonds that they were buying, they've got a lot of cash at the moment. Mm-hmm. Essentially, there's not a lot of people lending. They've got huge reserves at the Federal Reserve, and they need to do something with this cash. And what they do is they buy corporate bonds.
Sure.
But that exposes them to risks. That exposes them, especially at the moment, given that everyone is so worried about Europe. Every time something happens in Greece, what do? They buy the least risky asset, and that isn't corporate bonds, that's sovereign.
Right.
That's US sovereign bonds, treasury bonds as we know them. Okay. Mm-hmm. So JP Morgan have a lot of these assets, they want to hedge, but it's too costly, far too costly to actually hedge each and individual position. And so what they can do is actually set up this strange, complex derivative trade where they're hedging and they don't actually have to put any cash up front to do it. And the crux of the matter is that when they're putting this hedge on, Jamie Dimon in his office is thinking, well, we're hedging an exposure here with this derivatives cashless hedging trade strategy somewhere else.
Right.
But the trader himself is trying to make money.
Exactly. And therein lies the key. The trader is trying to get as much money for himself and for the company as possible.
Right, right. There's a problem here. There's a disconnect between the intent of the bigger picture and the underlying intent of the trader. Now the trader has to do that. If the trader is not thinking like a trader, then they're not actually doing their job.
Right.
But this is why on the outside, it's a very confusing issue for people, because we were all told under the Volcker rule, named after Paul Volcker, once upon a time chairman of the Federal Reserve in the 77 to 86, I think it was something like that term. Mm-hmm. He came up with this idea that banks shouldn't be allowed to proprietary trade, i.e. use their own capital to bet. And we all thought, and although the Volcker rule isn't as yet, it's due to come into effect over the next year or so, but already banks have got rid of their proprietary trading. I think that's the case.
That's the most obvious place where you see prop trading is in an in-house hedging fund. That's easy. We can draw a bright line box around it. We can call it prop trading, and we can shed it if necessary. But what was going on in this loss is it's on the verge between risk management, prop trading, perhaps market making. And really, what the intent of Volcker is to try to get into the minds of the bankers mm-hmm. and to decide exactly what this trade is, but you can't judge it on the basis of loss. I'd like to remind our viewers that regulation cannot eliminate losses from Wall Street. That's
right.
Not the point of regulation. Banks will make losses in the future. They've actually made money on this exact position in previous quarters.
Right.
This was a bad quarter. It was a horrible 6 weeks. And that's not to say that 6 weeks from hence, this position mm-hmm. does not turn profitable. So if we judge prop trading on the basis of loss, that judgment will be misinformed.
Right. And I think the key thing here is that ultimately, I think most people agreed that Volcker just won't cover this kind of trading. That this kind of trading, the trader is thinking like a proprietary trader, but Volcker will never really be able to get into the specifics of a trade like this. It's just not going to happen. The intent is hedging.
But one outcome of this trade may be that the grasp of Volcker may tighten. And so this whole idea of portfolio hedging is very controversial.
Mm-hmm.
When people think of a hedge, what they'd like to think of is a simplified hedge. I have this risk that I hedge directly with this instrument. That wasn't the case here. The trader was hedging risk across the firm, a basket of assets, and it's called portfolio hedging, something Jamie Dimon has argued should be a part of risk management activities because it's less expensive.
Right.
Volcker may proceed by eliminating portfolio hedges because of this loss last week.
Well, that is the central political ramification. We shall see if it happens.
Right. We're speaking with Chris Payne and Neela Richardson, a couple of senior finance analysts, economists, if you will, with Bloomberg Government. This is Capital Impact on Federal News Radio. You guys mentioned derivatives. I want to dive into those in just a minute. But I want to take a step back for a second, Chris. On May 11th, just a day after the report of the law, Senators Levin and Merkley, who are the principal co-sponsors for the Volcker rule, held a press conference and cited this issue as a quote-unquote textbook illustration of why Volcker is needed. Yet the insight that you guys have penned basically said we need Basel, not Volcker. Let's take a step back now. What is Basel. Basel.
It's more than just an urban.
It's more than just a city in Switzerland, too. What is it, and why is this the preferred method what would you feel this is the preferred method over Volcker?
Well, I guess firstly to say that it's not that – I mean, the question mark is whether Volcker would have even covered this mm-hmm. hedge and whether it will in the future. But stepping away from Volcker, Basel, by the way, is connected to the city in Switzerland because that's where the rules were actually written, right. Basel rules, so it doesn't stand for anything. It is Basel, Switzerland. and it's where regulators from around the world get together. It was set up in the early 1930s, this committee, and they get together to write rules for banks. And there's a new set of rules coming out after the financial crisis. It was thought that Basel II wasn't sufficient, so now we have Basel III. Mm-hmm. And the rules are mainly about capital. Now, what is capital? Capital is the shareholders' funds. It's what a bank, but it's the bank's own finance and funding. Mm-hmm. So if you think about a bank, what's it made up of? It's made up of loans and investments, and it has some cash. And that's its assets. And then it has to fund that. How does it fund those assets? Well, it borrows a lot, and it borrows a lot from depositors like you and me, who put our money in the bank. Right. And it also borrows from other banks and other big financial institutions. Money market mutual funds are a big source of borrowing for banks. And it issues bonds as well. But it also, about, say, 4% or 5% of the funding is capital, its own shareholders' fund. It's retained profits that it's built up over the years, plus its initial capital that it's raised.
Right.
And the idea is capital is a very good source of funds because you can write off losses can be absorbed by shareholders before creditors have to take a loss.
And that was the case in this particular instance.
And that's really the point. So Basel is saying, Basel III came along and said, we need more capital, significantly more capital, probably double, if not more than double the amount of core shareholders' funds which mm-hmm. can absorb losses. And we need it to be better quality. We can't have all these strange hybrid instruments like trust, preferred securities, counting as core capital. Now, I'm not going to go into the detail of them. Right. More of it and better quality. And what this loss shows really clearly is that if there's one thing, we've already discussed this, JP Morgan is a very well-capitalized bank. Jamie Dimon refers to the balance sheet of JP Morgan as a fortress balance sheet. And what he means by that is there's a lot of capital backing those assets, which can absorb losses. There's a lot of liquid assets. Basel III also talks about having a lot of liquid assets on hand that can be sold very quickly for cash
right.
to pay back creditors. No one is questioning the security, if you like, the solvency of JP Morgan. And I think if one thing's clear, it's that losses like these can be absorbed. It's always going to happen. We're in a stressed market environment at the moment. You're going to have, there's bound to be one big financial institution that's going to have a problem at the
sure.
moment.
And that's one capital of the limitations it. Of Volcker. It only looks at the level of risk, but it doesn't look at the capacity to absorb that risk.
Right.
And you have to really look at both the level and the capacity to absorb. And until you do that, you can't really adequately judge if that position, that credit derivative or whatever type of derivative is too aggressive given the bank's portfolio.
So, and that's where Basel III comes in. It makes sure that you have those assets on hand to absorb a potential
Absolutely.
Loss of sorts.
You don't have to judge intent. You don't have to rely on generous traders who value the solvency of the firm more than their own compensation. You don't have to rely on risk models that may blow up or underperform
right.
in highly stressed scenarios. You rely on shareholder equity to absorb and protect depositors.
Absolutely. Derivatives. Let's talk about those real quick. We've got a couple of minutes left. The risk management model is using these derivatives. Where is this cash coming from? Why should we be concerned about them?
Well, we all know if we look at our checking accounts, the interest rates are at an all-time low.
Right.
And they're at an all-time low from banks, too. So they have to do something with these deposits that are on their balance sheet. They're not lending as much as they used to. So they take these deposits and they buy these high-quality liquid assets that Chris has just mentioned. They may buy corporate bonds, sovereign bonds. They may lend to corporations. But in a highly stressed credit scenario, the one that J.P. Morgan thought it was facing, they need to hedge that risk. And they'll do that using a derivative, a credit derivative. But as I said before, it's not a one-to-one hedge.
Right.
It's It's known as a synthetic hedge. It's a basket of instruments or an index that they were investing in. They may have taken both long and short positions, which means they were both buying and selling this risk of the asset. Mm-hmm. And they basically, it's a timing issue. They got caught in a bad timing. The market moved against this hedge at this particular time, and it resulted in a $2 billion loss.
There's also an element of a lack of transparency.
Lack of transparency. So we've talked a lot about Basel. We talked a lot about Volcker. What we haven't talked about are the, you know, 80-plus rules on derivatives trading that the CFTC and the SEC are propagating right now, writing right now, and how that will affect risk management going forward into the trading of derivatives. That's a whole other conversation.
Very good. Very good. So Bloomberg TV's Inside Track host Eric Schatzker reported from the shareholders meeting on the 15th in Tampa. And there were about 250 people in the room. He said about a dozen or so actually asked questions. None of them pinned them down, Jamie Dimon, that is, on what actually happened.
That's true, but you can bet that there's some private conversations.
I'm sure there were. I know Eric had a private conversation as well.
But the reality is that they wouldn't understand the answer, frankly. And it would be interesting to have Jamie Dimon in this room and actually get him to explain to us the complexity of these trades. They are so complex. They're looking at curves,
right.
i.e., you know, what it costs to borrow a short and a long term, and they're trying to wonder whether they can trade the flattening of the curve or the inverse. They're very, very complex. No shareholder, you'd be a special shareholder in a shareholders meeting to even
understand.
And
that's why it's kind of ridiculous that the OCC and the FBI and the Justice Department thinks that a bunch of lawyers and FBI agents are going to be able to understand this transaction a little bit better than the risk managers at J.P. Morgan.
I mean, we do live in a world, and you think about long-term capital management, a big hedge fund that went bust about 1998, we live in a complex world, and it's getting more and more complex to regulate, and you're going to see more kind of implosions like this, I'm afraid, in volatile times.
Christopher Payne, Neela Richardson, the insight is called J.P. Morgan Losses Prove Need for Basel, Not Volcker. You've also penned a BGov study, Chris, The Effect of Basel Liquidity Rules on Largest Banks. It's out there on BGov.com. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
All right, we're going to continue our finance discussion by taking a look at the Hill side of things with our man on the street, the guy on the Hill, congressional analyst Lauren Duggan. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you for coming. So J.P. Morgan lost $2 billion on May 10th. On May 11th, Senator Bob Corker called Senate Banking Committee Chairman Tim Johnson and said, hey, you know what? We need a hearing on this, quote unquote, as expeditiously as possible. So are we looking at a sequel to, you know, Dodd-Frank? Is this Dodd-Frank 2?
Well, it's hard to say because Dodd-Frank 1 is really still being implemented.
Right. Which lends itself to a sequel.
Which lends itself to a sequel sometimes. I mean, there's other people who want to see the whole thing go away. They want to scrap the whole project.
Sure.
But what we're already seeing are hearings, as you suggested. There were some scheduled for this week, not necessarily on the J.P. Morgan situation, but just generally on banking regulations. And those are becoming fodder for questions about what happened to J.P. Morgan, what did regulators know, and when did they know it. Legislation, I don't know if we'll see that necessarily. Some people are going to use this as a talking point. This proves we need legislation, whereas other people like Spencer Baucus have already said, there's no law you can write that can prevent a company from doing this sort of thing, so why would we do it? So it'll be interesting. I think people are going to start to fall along party lines on this a little bit, but maybe there's consensus coming because no one wants to be caught on the wrong side of this sort of issue.
So you said there were some hearings actually scheduled.
Right.
I'm imagining they're taking a step back now and reassessing the situation as a result of J.P. Morgan.
Right. Maybe not so much on the hearing side because that's about getting intelligence about what to do on legislation. But there was a markup scheduled actually for May 17th that was going to be on some swaps legislation dealing with the implementation of derivatives rules in Dodd-Frank. And that was actually canceled in light of the J.P. Morgan thing, not because there was any connection, the chairman said, because the losses that J.P. Morgan had nothing to do with derivatives necessarily, but he didn't want any unintended consequences. So they took a step back. Let's get some information on this and then go back to this legislation. I would still expect they'd do that markup at a later date.
Right, right. Actually, what's funny about that, as we just heard from both Chris and Neela, there was some derivative action in this, talking synthetic derivatives. So a little bit of play there. Maybe there was something in the background causing them to take a step back.
There could be. And I guess as a member of Congress, you don't want to go forward on something if there's any question about what we're doing.
Let's shift gears just a little bit. Lauren, stick with me, okay? I want to introduce a defense analyst by the name of Rob Levinson. Rob, good morning.
Good morning, Alan.
Thanks for joining us here on the program. We've got a bunch of stuff going on under H.R. 4310. On the Hill. We're talking appropriations. $554 billion on core defense programs. What are we getting for our money? If I throw out some terms for you, can you give me a snapshot of where we're headed with what's going on?
Sure.
All right, so let's take a look at weapons programs.
Yeah, on weapons programs, you know, as you've seen before and again this time in the defense authorization bill, the Congress is trying to get the military sometimes to hold on to programs it doesn't really want, like the C-27 airlift, the small airlifter the Air Force wants to get rid of, or the Global Hawk, unmanned aerial vehicle Block 30. Again, Congress is trying to slow down or stop the Air Force from canceling these programs, as the Air Force did in part of its budget. And there's always that kind of tension between, what the Congress likes to push things on the military sometimes that it doesn't even need or want.
We're talking $3.2 billion under the existing law in fiscal 2013 for things like submarines. Nothing important, just submarines. All right, and Lauren, feel free to chime in here as well.
Sure. I mean, even if you look at the overall numbers in this bill, it's about $4 billion more than the Obama administration requested in this defense policy or authorization bill that's coming up. So they're already ahead of the administration by that. And then if you look at individual programs, you start to see where they've increased funding or given funding, sometimes where the administration doesn't want it.
Let's talk about East Coast missile defense with regard.
Missile defense has always sort of been a point of division between the Democrats and the Republicans. And the Republicans, going back to Ronald Reagan, have really sworn by missile defense. And they're always sort of pushing the envelope on it. Now they want to study on an East Coast site to protect us from Iranian missiles or something like that. Again, this is not something the administration is really anxious to, or the military for that matter. You know, missile defense has been plagued by a lot of setbacks and things like that. The technology is still largely unproven in many areas. So, again, this is a real pressure point often between the Republicans and the Democrats.
We're speaking with Rob Levinson and Lauren Duggan here on Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact, right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And Rob recently authored a BGov insight entitled Security Contracts in Afghanistan Jeopardized. Now, as a part of this H.R. 4310, the House has actually proposed a security guard restriction that would impact defense contractors. Give me a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, basically, a lot of our facilities in Afghanistan are guarded by private security contractors. Some of them are Afghan, some of them are British, but there are U.S. companies. And I think the figure for last year was about $140 million in these contracts. And basically, the legislation would prohibit the use of those contractors, period. It would also prohibit the use of what's called the Afghan Public Forces, which is another group that Afghanistan set up to sort of eventually take over this mission.
Right.
And so basically would require more U.S. troops in Afghanistan to sort of guard these facilities, because the committees expressed concern that there have been a lot of incidents where some of these Afghan private security guards or even uniformed Afghan personnel have, you know, shot at Americans or even in some cases killed Americans. And so they want to prevent this. It's also sort of a backhanded way, perhaps, of trying to keep more troops in Afghanistan.
About 26,612 security contractors in Afghanistan, 95% of them Afghans, in preparation to take over themselves. And unfortunately, it looks like there may be a cut in the works.
Yeah, again, this is an area of contention. The administration statement of administration policy said that they opposed this provision. So, you know, it remains to be seen if it'll survive through the Senate and, you know, how far the president will go with allowing this to go through if it remains in the final legislation.
Will you come back and give us some more information on this as time passes?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Definitely. Cool. Rob Levinson, his insight is entitled Security Contracts in Afghanistan Jeopardized. It's all part of H.R. 4310. Good stuff to take a look at on BGov.com. Lauren, thank you very much for joining us, as usual.
Thanks, as always, for having me.
Great to see you here in the studio. Rob, thanks for coming in as well.
Thanks. It's a lot of fun.
I appreciate it. That just about does it. This week's Capital Impact is over on Federal News Radio. Just a reminder, you can learn more about Bloomberg Government's award-winning analysis, tools, and data at www.bgov.com. That's bgov.com. If you're a social media file, take a look at Twitter, at Bloomberg Gov. Thanks to Christopher Payne, Neela Richardson, Lauren Duggan, and, of course, Robert Levinson, whose bodies of work can all be found at www.bgov.com. Let's get together again next Thursday, shall we? 11 a.m.? Got lots to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.